Coming up on this week's Redcast.
So what we're not so good at is the how. And that's what regulators have really dialed in on in the last couple of years, and it's starting to get pretty intensive.
A lot of the stuff you see in the technology space, you do see again and again, just in different formats. These are things that people need to think about. And that means we're planning properly at the board level. Simply saying we're going to save money by using cloud systems or bringing in some version of what we claim is AI doesn't necessarily deliver outcomes.
And at the core of that, it's smelling and feeling like they're really focusing on cloud concentration risk. People making these decisions and defining these strategies that have never worked deep in tech. At all of the banks I have worked in, there is still this giant dividing line between business and tech. Collective procurement and deployment of shared solutions really could help not only with some of these cloud concentration risk challenges, but also coordinated attack prevention and remediation.
See, as one of the big drivers for next year is the transparency that all those watchers are going to be asking the firms and the technology suppliers. But don't forget, those technology suppliers are getting directly regulated for the first time.
Welcome to Redcast.
Redcast. Redcast.
Shining a light on challenges and opportunities for digital compliance.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I'm PJ DiGiammarino, CEO and founder of JWG, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to Season 2, Episode 20, which is covering digital infrastructure risk. Now, the premise for this one is that there are fundamentally new rules on the landscape for banks and their technology providers. A recent Forbes article pitched it as new regulation is going to fundamentally change the landscape for the biggest tech companies. I would add, and their customers, meaning all the banks and everyone else that's using the services. And really, I think what we're seeing here now over the past couple of years has been a recognition in the system by the regulators that there's a huge systemic risk posed by the way we're leveraging technology. In the last two decades, we've covered lots and lots of rules. We've added lots and lots of tech to be able to help with all that. We can tell you, you know, who's trading what where and you know how and all the risks around that. But what we're not so good at is the how. And that's what regulators have really dialed in on in the last couple of years. And it's starting to get pretty intensive. So you need to think about your operational resilience. You need to think about your third-party relationships and anything that's called outsourcing. And then there's a whole bunch of rules around technology governance itself. And these things get really complicated. It's easy to say AI, but when you go to define it and look at what's done within the firm, everything becomes AI, which means all of your technology now is subject to new subjective principles about how things are meant to work. And you have to do things like explain how it works and look at how risky it is from the customer's point of view. So we have an abundance of data and cloud-based connectivity out there. The industry is doing lots of creative things, and we're continuing to push the envelope into more and more of the processing to take advantage of some of the economies of scale. But we're about to get hit with some pretty severe operational risk type controls that people are going to be checking up on. And ultimately, the board owns, because when you start looking at all these different controls, there's only one place they can all go. And that's something that's going to be very, very new and very challenging and difficult to get to grips with. So that's the conversation we're having here today. We have two excellent professionals with us. Let's kick off with Jonathan. Can you please introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your background?
Thank you, PJ. For myself, my name is Jonathan Hatch. I'm a senior advisor and lawyer in the Innovation Hub, which is part of ASIC's, which is Australia's Financial Services Conduct and Markets Regulator. Our focus is obviously in the Innovation Hub, trying to help people in the innovation space. The more broader regulator engages right across the market in the conduct and market spaces. My personal background is actually a wealth lawyer, and I'm also an academic who teaches across things like automation and artificial intelligence, hence my presence here today.
Thanks very much. And good evening to you, and good morning to you, Monica.
Good morning, PJ. Good evening, Jonathan. My name is Monica Sasso. I am Red Hat's EMEA Financial Services Chief Technologist, and I'm based in London. I joined Red Hat a couple years ago from the industry, so from Deutsche Wealth Management. So Jonathan, you and I are two peas in a pod here today, where I spent most of my career delivering large global regulatory and digital transformation initiatives. So I always say for my sins, I delivered MiFID II for Deutsche Wealth Management globally. So I'm au fait with all of the regulations and all of the challenges that firms and regulators as well have in this space. So looking forward to the conversation.
Well, thanks very much, Monica. I'm going to ask you to kick off, which is really give us your perspective on the not so much the drivers behind the rules themselves, but the drivers within the firms that have to adopt them. What is it like to have to get to this inspection of the how?
I mean, I think part of it is a learning curve for them. I think, you know, if you think about the view, and I obviously come from a tech firm, so I can't speak like I'm a regulator, but I definitely can speak as a consumer and as somebody who has a vested interest in the system being stable. But I think at the coalface, it's all about building integrity and resilience into the banking and financial systems. That's definitely a top priority for governments and regulators globally. But I think the bottom line is they are thinking about it about the holistic stability of the wider financial system. And at the core of that, it's smelling and feeling like they're really focusing on cloud concentration risk. So that is the systematic risks associated with outsourcing common business critical functions, such as payments or clearing, for example, to a single cloud provider or a handful of public cloud providers. So if there's a disruption or a vulnerability occurs within such a provider, the spillover impact could be significant if multiple financial institutions are reliant on that service without having sufficient redundancy. And by that, you know, we think portability or the ability to move that application or service to a different location, whether that be to a private cloud, which is in your own data center, or to another public cloud provider. And the stat that scares me a tiny bit living in the UK, it came out about a year ago, but it was from the Bank of England, and they said over 65% of UK firms, so financial services and insurance companies, use the same four cloud providers for all their cloud infrastructure services, which gives that instability feel. You know, we're not talking about geopolitical stuff. We're just talking about putting all of your eggs in one cloud-shaped basket, for example. And at the same time, though, you know, banks want to run. They want the flexibility. They want to run different applications in different clouds at different times, depending on their needs or their strategy, so that they can drive business growth and modernize and compete with the startups and the fintechs. And it's not going away, right? Gartner predicted earlier this year that public cloud spend was going to top $500 million U.S. dollars by the end of this year. That's massive. And these technology supply chains are becoming, which means that these technology supply chains are becoming quite complex. I think I need coffee too, PJ. So obviously, you know, the result is that there is a wider and a potentially a more vulnerable surface area for attacks as well, which then have this risk of cascading down to the system, the wider system, for failures or outages. So not to paint a bleak picture, but that's where I think as a consumer and as a tech company, where the regulators and governments are focusing or on the how.
Jonathan, how do you come at it?
Interesting thing with cloud and all technologies is they're somewhat analogous when you see the issues. There are always nuances based on the technology, and that's to be expected. But the fascinating thing that crossed my mind recently that Monica's just reminded me of is that just before I joined ASIC about 10 years ago, I had to draft a lot of contracts with cloud providers for outsourcing. I remember working through some of the risks. A lot of those risks actually popped up in ASIC's recent cyber resilience good practices, things like working through a proper strategy, having appropriate risk management strategies, cybersecurity, assets and detection of systems problems, all the normal things you'd be expected to do. The reason I raise all that, partly is obviously PropDesk's work, but also partly is a lot of the stuff you see in the technology space, you do see again and again, just in different formats. You need to think about it often, and you're actually a practitioner. I say this as an ex-industry lawyer working in a regulator, that things do come up, but they're not necessarily brand new. They may be related to the technology. They may be specifically nuanced to the technology. For example, a lot of the work with AI may be susceptible to data issues that haven't been as big a challenge in the past. But in the case of cloud, you're fundamentally relying on an outsource provider. And if everyone uses the same outsource provider, that's a risk. If your outsource provider decides to go bankrupt or doesn't decide to go bankrupt and simply does, you may have a problem. These are things that people need to think about. And that means planning properly at the board level. Because though it's not my place to speak to any other regulator's jurisdiction or government policy, it is something that people need to be aware of to ensure that good consumer outcomes do eventuate.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that point. And actually, something in this Forbes article I just mentioned, they pitted another industry commentator saying boards don't know anything about technology. And I sort of take a different view. I mean, if you're under 50, you've kind of grown up in an environment where all this stuff is very real and part of your business. So how can you not be aware of it? And I guess that's fundamentally, Monica, where I guess these control questions land, because things like operational resilience require the board to actually go through the scenarios, the risks, the controls, the accountability, the strategy, the testing, all that kind of good stuff, right?
But yes, and I think now we're kind of moving a little bit into esoteric-y type stuff, because I do, to your point, right, anybody under 50, thankfully I'm under 50, should know something about technology. I think the challenge here is you've got people maybe that are under 50 or over 50 indeed making these decisions. But even more importantly, you've got people making these decisions and defining these strategies that have never worked deep in tech. The only reason why I know a lot of these things is because I now left the business side of a bank and went to a tech company. At all of the banks I have worked in, there is still this giant dividing line between business and tech. So absolutely, Jonathan, I agree with you, right? Planning has to happen at the board level. Strategy has to happen at the board level. But people need to really, we need to start educating the decision makers what it means when you say, I'm going to go spend all of my IT money with a public cloud provider because they've promised me amazing stuff and innovation. And we can really, compete much better with the regtechs and the fintechs. And we can start to deliver a new way of working, blah, blah, blah. But the reality of it is they've made that decision. They've not bothered to jump over that wall and have a conversation with the people that do it to even understand, A, is it possible within the architecture? B, is it possible within, all of the constraints of the controls? And C, is that money really value for money when it comes time to, yes, we've removed a whole bunch of 150 lines of operational risk from our risk register, but you've also introduced 150 new ones that are actually kind of different now. So I think, to echo what you said, Jonathan, to close out on this first point, is I think education is key. And I think we've got people that don't necessarily appreciate or haven't been given the opportunity to understand and learn all of these things before making the best decisions.
Yeah, I guess I question whether they ever could understand them. I mean, when I worked in a bank, I landed and said, right, show me how the architecture works. And you had to go talk to 100 people to figure that out. Yeah. And if you then peel it back, say, okay, well, when were these investments made?
It was 1974.
Like there were lots of archaeological sediment layers you had to dig through just to understand what had happened and how the thing got built, right? So it's a bit like that those shows where they go dig some trenches and people go through them just to figure out that one bit and figure out where the building was. But there isn't necessarily a plan, right? So there isn't necessarily a spec you can go to public planning and pull it off the internet and say, okay, this is what I need to do. So what is that going to mean for the people in these different silos that you were talking about, Monica? How are that in terms of the big challenges for next year? What has to happen within the regulated space as well as the regulator?
I mean, I can say where when we speak with customers and where our focus is for next year on three kind of very techie areas, and I will talk about them in a second, but all three of them are absolutely underpinned by corporate culture and process, processes and people and processes basically being modernized alongside of the technology. And I think we have this funny thing where we as consumers are demanding software at speed. Big companies are starting to be able to deliver software at speed so that if I want to have my investment app updated every week, it can with all these new features. It is. But maybe the I will posit that maybe the people and the processes at firms haven't caught up yet with that pace. Their overall operating model hasn't caught up with that pace of how software is delivered. And, you know, when we talk to customers, we see that they're struggling with eliminating technical debt. And a huge amount of that is really about simplifying and standardizing technology estates, which actually comes back to, you know, reducing cost to run, obviously, but it's about digitizing and automating to drive some of these efficiencies. And that actually is a culture and a process change. That's not necessarily just a tech change. The second thing that we're seeing customers kind of grapple with is how do they chart their own flight paths to cloud native capabilities? Again, kind of goes hand in hand with this tech debt thing. And it does talk about people and processes, and it does talk about, you know, how companies can use cloud technology to deliver better innovation for their customers and for their employees as well on their own terms. That's the most important thing, right? It's at the speed that the firm wants. So, you know, some of the public cloud technology gives much more flexibility than firms have ever had, just simply by the nature of its pay as you go. And then the third thing, you know, that we're speaking a lot with customers about is actually why we're here today talking, PJ and Jonathan. It's about how to use it all, if you will, to build digital operational a personal, if you will, digital operation resilience playbook and chart their own path to compliance using technology, because technology isn't going anywhere. It's ubiquitous, right? And I think in that angle, all three of those things point to the fact that resilience and innovation, they need to be partners, not opposing forces. And organizations really should take a holistic approach with, you know, security baked in to the DNA of their overall ecosystem and technology supply chain, rather than add all of it as an afterthought. So all of that techie stuff aside, it does really ultimately come back to, I think, culture and processes to drive the adoption and build that resilience with the technology.
Jonathan?
A lot of good points. I keep thinking through automation as a space generally. Now, everyone talks about digitization. It kind of is the thing at the moment, and it probably has been for a very long time. Firstly, that worries me because having worked in this space for some time, whenever something is the thing, a lot of people come in as the solution provider claiming they have all the answers and are willing to take your money to do it. So that's the first challenge, but that's not what I was going to say. The bigger ones I actually think about is things like working out how corporate governance will actually fit with what you're trying to do. That means looking at the business as a whole. And yes, I'd say board is responsible, but it may mean people need to understand what's going on from the top to the bottom, as we've alluded to in some of the institutions. It also may mean that in many cases, when you are bringing technology in, there's as big a process of bringing the technology in as, in terms of the selection, as there needs to be the assessment of what the organization is actually doing, what interdependencies there are within the organization, what processes they may impact by doing certain technological developments. And if you do take this sort of blow everything up and restart and rebuild internally, you need to ensure that the business remains operational, because it's not an excuse to have digital misconduct as an justification for bad conduct. Just like any other regulated population, you need to meet the requirements imposed. And that means that often it's necessary, and a lot of organizations are setting such priorities, including ASIC, are looking at how the company will use technology and things like data and analytics moving forwards. But it means the technology that's used has to be used correctly, and you actually have to understand what it's doing. One of my frustrations as an academic, having taught this and having seen it in the standards space where I work with some of the industry standards development, is that people come into this space, look at it, and try and impose things because they want to finish something, say a KPI in a certain time period. But sometimes it takes time and effort to really develop the right solution and work through what is the best practice, whether that be ISO or IEEE standards, whether that be employing different technological solutions, or whether that be a matter of working through how laws are changing and how a business may need to adapt. Rather than just band-aiding another technology solution on top, there's often the need to actually work through the consequences. And maybe because a lot of this software is often sold as an efficiency, there are other benefits that need to be considered as part of the process, such as improved compliance, adopting commit some sort of cooperation models with things like RegTech or subtech providers to deliver better outcomes and work through how things like digital regulatory reporting can be done more efficiently.
Well, a lot of great points there. And I guess, you know, across both of your points, you know, I sprung to mind while you were talking the BCBS 239 poll, the latest one that they did. The 239 is a bunch of principles for how you manage data. And the last survey of all the GCIFIs, the systemically important firms, came back with a lower benchmark rating than the last one recently. And I was curious and I dug through why, and they blame the cloud. And you know why? I had to go talk to people last, well, why is that? How did that happen? And they said, well, it basically everybody now can make their own decisions. So the quality of the data goes down because everybody's ring fencing and saying, I'm going to do it my way over here because it's my business and I'm paying for it, darn it. So I think a lot of the things that you're speaking about get back to who controls the unit of technology, whether that be a headcount or whether it be investment in the platform. And ultimately, I think that's where the battleground goes in terms of how do we think about justifying some of these decisions. Monica, in your discussions, what are you seeing around those kind of, especially in a budget constrained environment like now, how's that going?
I'm going to be careful about how I'm going to try to tiptoe around some of it, some of that, PJ, but I think I can, it's only been 2 years since I was at a big bank, so I can appreciate that. But I think there's a lot of parallels here. We see this when we go and we speak with heads of architecture, heads of infrastructure, or CIOs. There's a lot of these, the shadow IT, right? And some of that is a result of exactly what you just described, right? I'm a business line owner. I'm an MD. I'm a product owner. I want to get my payments platform doing whatever the best thing is possible because I'm remunerated on volume of payments, for example, right? Again, I'm kind of making it all up. I want to go and just spin up an environment in a public cloud environment because I want to get stuff done faster. I want to innovate better. I want to be able to deliver more value to the firm. And you end up in that scenario, exactly as you described, where you've got people that are kind of not necessarily following, not following the rules, but they're not totally following them either. And these rules are there for a reason. And this is where I think we have some of these silos, you know, that Jonathan that maybe alluded to, or I guess I alluded to, not Jonathan. Sorry, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Jonathan. And you know, you've got maybe your silos over here for data, you've got your compliance over here, your controls here, you've got your business here, and then you've got your IT ops guys here, and then you have your IT devs over there. And you've got to find a way to go across all of them if you have a problem and you want to deliver something for it. So I do think it's a symptom of big companies in general. It's not just exclusive to financial services, but also financial services is very, has this much more acutely, I think, because it is such a highly regulated area. And we have, you know, if you're a global bank, right, you've got hundreds of regulators that you have to comply to, thousands of regulations that you have to comply with. And then, you know, there's so many threads that are similar between all of them, but you in the past have always implemented them in an isolated way. And now you want to try to do stuff fast and you really can't. You can't do stuff fast and follow the rules. It's a challenge. Is really the thing, and I think that's what we're talking about right now.
Very true. I would just quickly add there that the thing that comes to mind as we discuss this, again, I'm going to tiptoe around the question a little bit, PJ, is you get what you measure. Yes, it's sounding very academic on my part, but if you tell IT or you tell a business unit, either one, they need to cut costs 10%. They'll probably manage to cut costs 10%. You may have follow-on consequences you don't like. And at a management level, that needs to be allowed for. Simply saying we're going to save money by introducing cloud systems or bringing in some version of what we claim is AI doesn't necessarily deliver outcomes. And the fact that many people don't actually understand what they're talking about, because I still remember the example I gave you before, people saying cloud could solve all sorts of existing issues, such as policy. I'm still as yet to see cloud solve policy in 10 years. So it's what you need to think about in the governance and selection. More importantly, it's also about understanding what your colleagues in other areas of the business are doing and what the expectations are from them, because they are all stakeholders in a lot of important decision-making that might mean engaging with them early rather than coming at the 11th hour and telling someone, this is what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you both made very excellent points. It was a challenging question, so thank you for answering it. And I guess in terms of then the conclusions we can all draw from that and try to get, well, what are the real things that people will get when they come to listen to you on the conference, which is coming up now next week, 9th, 10th of November. What are some of the things that you think people will be taking away from our conversation about the how, Monica?
Yeah, I don't want to. I think it's very clear now that financial institutions, their systems, if you will, do not operate in isolation, right? So resiliency and security, they need to be a cross industry effort. There has to be some sort of single pane of glass solution to security, where in organizations they pull down their walls of secrecy and they allow other teams to collaborate using the same view of this data, right? So now we've converged into risk and security. And I think these two are so linked when you start looking at shared providers in a public space, especially in a non-regulated service provider. So I do think we need to look at, more sector-wide strategies. And I think this is where maybe the regulators are trying to look at that. I actually don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, but I do know when I speak with customers and colleagues in firms, they are talking to each other much more than I ever remember speaking with, dare I say, reaching across the aisle. So things like collective selection, collective procurement, and deployment of shared solutions really could help not only with some of these cloud concentration risk challenges, but also coordinated attack prevention and remediation processes, which are huge elements of the UK and the EU's various DORA acts or operational resiliency things going on. So I do think we're going to start to see some of these conversations percolate in around about how we can maybe collectively solve for some of these problems, so that the firms can actually use some of the awesome benefits or realize some of the awesome benefits that the public cloud gives them in terms of innovation or delivering software faster, maybe being more agile, all of those sorts of key buzzwords that I think we're all sick of hearing. But that's the reality of what new technology offers. And I do think that, one of the key takeaways that Red Hat hopes JWG's conference attendees will have is that all of this points to having a much more community-minded approach to reducing digital threats and reducing cloud concentration risk and increasing operational resilience.
Thank you very much. Very well said. Jonathan?
I'll simply say that for those looking to join, obviously it's going to be helping them understand what's going on in the environment around them, helping them understand, because there's quite a range of people attending, presenting on different views, and it'll help them use that understanding to better deliver compliant outcomes, manage things like certain governance risks or failures that could otherwise come up, and be more mindful of certain cyber governance and resilience challenges they need to think about, whether that be in cloud or any other technology, things like AI standards, use of other certain distributed ledger systems for registry functions, whatever else. All of these things are things that need to be kept in mind, because misconduct is something that regulators will look at worldwide, and increasingly, particularly as economies move in different paths, will be something that pops up on the radar more and more.
Yeah, and I can only agree with both of you, and thank you for your perspectives. So, what I see as one of the big drivers for next year is the transparency that all those watchers are going to be asking the firms and the technology suppliers. But don't forget, those technology suppliers are getting directly regulated for the first time, and that's going to definitely change things. So things have been inching towards actually having reports. Who are, who is doing what for whom? And that is now going to be a whole different conversation about, well, where are those risks and how are we going to manage them? So that's the challenge for the rest of the decade, frankly. That's not going to get sorted out anytime soon. But come dial in and listen to what everyone has to say on the 9th and 10th of November. We're also 6 months on demand, and really looking forward to getting your feedback as well. Please rate and review us if you like what you heard on this podcast. And I'll just leave me to thank Monica and Jonathan for their morning and afternoon.
Pleasure.
You.
Thanks very much, guys.
You can download the podcast via Spotify, Apple, and Google. But also, I'd encourage people to come to the JWG website, which, as hopefully you will know, is jwg-it.eu. Go to the Intelligence Hub and create your bespoke library.
This is Redcast.
Shining a light on challenges and opportunities for digital compliance.